What's the best way to avoid crime? How can Alaska law enforcement officers and prosecutors lower rates of arrest and incarceration? Direct engagement with the community when there hasn't been a 911 call may be part of the answer. Community policing, listening sessions for prosecutors and officers in schools are all part of a larger law enforcement effort to build trust and better communication with Alaska residents. Engaging the community in policing is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Interactions between police, prosecutors, and the public have been in the spotlight. Why are these problems so prevalent in the last few years, and what can those in law enforcement do to address it? In Alaska, land of incredible diversity, police and prosecutors are trying new techniques to promote positive interaction with the public. Here to help us understand what this outreach involves are Anchorage District Attorney Clint Campion. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Also in the studio is Captain Bill Miller. Captain Miller, I think I have this right. You head up APD's Crime Suppression Division?
Correct.
Yay. I'm glad I got that right. Thanks for being here, both of you. I forgot to check with you before we went on air. I want to discuss your current public outreach efforts and the concept of community policing and community prosecution. I also want to invite the public to join our conversation today. If you are in other parts of the state, you can join us at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. In researching this idea of community policing and community prosecuting, I was interested to find that the formation of the Anchorage Community Police Relations Task Force started 35 years ago. That was an interesting little fact that I found out. These ideas are much in the news nationally, but here in Alaska, there was an outreach effort that started decades ago. Captain Miller, you joined the force just a few years later, 1984. What was going on at that time that prompted the task force? What do you remember from those days?
I was actually a state trooper in 84, and I came to APD in 86. And it was right around that time. What happened is we had a fatal officer-involved shooting with a young man that was... To the best of my recollection, there were some mental health problems and some other things going on, but he was also a member of the minority community. And one of the things that came out of that shooting was an attempt by the minority community and the police department and the municipality and other law enforcement agencies in the city to get together to try and address any kind of problem, any kind of issues before they became problems. So the minority task force was formed. It's not just the Anchorage Police Department. It's also Alaska State Troopers, FBI, District Attorney's Office. We have various minority members from Hmong, African American, Pacific Islander, Korean. I'm sure there are a lot of others that I'm leaving out, but it was really a recognition that we wanted to stop or address issues before they became unmanageable problems.
Mm-hmm. So this, given the strife between police and citizens in other parts of the country that we've seen much in the news in the last few years, This long tenure seems like it could be instructive for how well these efforts do or don't work. Both of you have attended meetings, maybe are part of this task force. Tell us about what happens there. What's going on when they meet once a month and have for 35 years? Mm-hmm. What happens at these meetings? Mr. Campion?
I've been attending for the last 3 or 4 years, and in my role, I'm primarily an advisory role. What happens, most importantly, are the meetings are set up with an opportunity for members of the community to bring concerns before the task force, and the task force can respond in a variety of ways. We can set up a subcommittee to look into it, to conduct an investigation. More often than not, what happens is it involves interactions between a minority member of the community and the police department, and typically the chair of the task force, Reverend Green, will ask the police department to look into it and at least initially provide a report directly to the task force. And either Reverend Green and the members are happy or not happy, and that may result in additional investigation. But it gives an opportunity for everyone to step back and really look at not just that direct interaction, but some of the things that led up to it. Sometimes there are discussions about policies or procedures at APD. Sometimes it's a lack of understanding about why the police have to take a certain response. But in my time on the task force, I have seen APD modify policies, and there's no better example of that than the Anchorage Police Department's modification of its use of force regarding shooting at moving vehicles. And I know Captain Miller can talk about that more, but that was particularly relevant to me because I was involved in reviewing officer-involved shootings at the time that a lot of those discussions took place. And I think the task force deserves a certain amount of credit for changing that policy or forcing APD to change their policy.
Mm. Talk a little bit about those changes and how the task force, Captain Miller, has aided these interactions between the community and changing what happens within the police department itself.
When police departments form policy, we look at it from a perspective of what's the best way to do what's the best way or the maybe sometimes the most expedient way to accomplish our job. And so having other perspectives that aren't maybe an officer's view of the world helps us modify the policies. In this particular case, with the shooting at vehicle policies, we started to recognize that we were, number one, not being particularly effective at stopping vehicles by shooting at them with handguns. But number two, putting other community members at risk, either passengers in the vehicles or extraordinarily hard to hit a moving vehicle with a handgun when you're any distance away from it. So, you know, peripheral people and stuff like that. And it gives us an opportunity to stand back and look at a policy and try and adopt that policy to what will help us accomplish the job, the task that we've been given by the citizens of Anchorage. Sometimes also the ability to sit and explain to a subcommittee, again, like Mr. Campion said, why we do things that we have to do, obviously, along with worrying about the citizens of Anchorage, officers have to worry about whether or not they're going home at night. We have to worry about whether or not we're protecting third parties who may be out and about, as opposed to, having a bad guy running around wildly shooting out, up the streets. It gives us a chance to also explain our position and why we do some of the things that we do that may not be readily apparent. One of the best examples this last time that I was sitting on the committee was we had a felony stop that officers had done on a vehicle that had reportedly been involved in a shooting downtown. Turns out, in the end, that the people who were in the vehicle were not involved in the shooting, but the question really centered around why can't an officer just walk up to the vehicle and contact the occupants and quickly determine whether or not they were involved in the shooting and then let them go on their way? Well, the reason is because it was involved in a shooting and officers want to make sure that we don't have to shoot whoever the occupants are. We don't get engaged in a gun battle if we can prevent it at the outset. And so, having that kind of being able to explain that give and take in the light of day instead of immediately there at the scene helps a lot to diffuse misperceptions and also, you know, like Mr. Campion mentioned, you know, in some cases, maybe there is a better way for us to do things.
So sometimes talking it through helps reveal, maybe we could do this differently. Or, and certainly I would imagine that when you're talking to the community in a non-stressful setting, when it isn't in the heat of the moment and officers have to make decisions quickly, during a task force meeting, that the conversation has to be completely different than when it's a situation where you're trying to assess very quickly whether or not this is potentially going to escalate or not. So that has to be a dynamic that really changes part of the larger conversation overall, does it not?
Well, it does. And, you know, back in the 60s, it was all about challenging authority and, you know, not trusting, quote, the man. Well, that's well and good, but there's a time and a place to do that. The time and place, the rule of law, is that we do that in court. We do that, you know, when things aren't an emergent nature, when it's not out on the street and it's 3 a.m. and we're trying to figure out who shot who and who's the victim and who's the bad guy and is there anybody else at risk, either the public or the officers or things like that. So while that is a truism, there is a time and place for that. And the time and place is at a subcommittee meeting. The time and place is at court. The time and place is in the light of day where there is not anybody really at jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. And today we're talking about crime prevention and community policing, community prosecution, what these terms mean. And our guests today are Anchorage District Attorney Clint Campion and also APD Captain of Crime Suppression Bill Miller is in the studio with us. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, in Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422, and you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. You had mentioned, Captain Miller, before we went to air, the CIT, Crisis Intervention Program. Tell us what that is.
Love to, because it's a fantastic program. Back in the early 2000s, I was part of an initial group that was sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust to go to Memphis. Memphis had started a program that was, at the time, groundbreaking. It was called the Crisis Intervention Team, or CIT. And the idea was to give police officers specialized training in how to deal with people who were in immediate mental health crisis. A pretty significant number of our officer-involved shooting, or police, just speaking generally, police officer-involved shootings are, excuse me, when dealing with people who are in mental health crisis. And so what Memphis came up with was an idea to give officers enhanced training to recognize what types of mental health crisis people are in, but also partner them up with the mental health community. Doctors, psychiatrists, caseworkers, and try and figure out how we keep from having these people come in regular contact with law enforcement, because every time that happens, there's an increase in the chance that you're going to have to use some amount of force to bring the situation under control. And so we went down there, we developed a program for Anchorage. We have, since that time, had a CIT coordinator that was Wendy Shackelford for years and years and years, and now it's Ruth Adolph. And what they do is, if we have people who are in mental health crisis who keep coming in contact with the Anchorage Police Department, we'll pay special attention by trying to get them hooked into social service programs, either at the psychiatric emergency room, at API, with out on the street caseworkers, and try and figure out how we can address their mental health issues so that they don't become law enforcement issues where they're breaking the law or perhaps frightening members of the public or doing things that would require APD to respond. And so in that sense, it's a value in two ways. Number one is it gets the person hooked in with services so that they can at least live a balanced kind of life. But the other thing is, the benefit for the Anchorage Police Department is that even though we spend a little bit of extra time up front, it reduces our calls for service in the back end. Because if you have somebody who's wandering around downtown breaking windows or shouting or screaming or making people nervous, then we keep getting calls and call and call after call after call. And so what we do is we short circuit that and get the problem taken care of before it becomes unmanageable.
Mm-hmm. Give us kind of the 101 on what community policing is. When I hear that term, I immediately think of old movies with Officer Friendly walking the street. So what is community policing?
It's I'm laughing because there are three of us in this room and we'll have three different definitions. To me, community policing, I used to walk the avenue on 4th Avenue when it was still the avenue. I knew the people that were down there. I knew them by first name. They knew me. They knew when I was working, when I wasn't working. To me, it's the idea that the police department is just plugged into Anchorage in the community. You hear it from Peel's basic definitions of law enforcement: the public are the police, and the police are the public. Basically, to take that a step further, it's having police or having the public with enough confidence in their police department that they'll call us when they see something going wrong. They'll call us with tips when they know about crimes that have happened and help us solve those crimes. But in addition, it's things like school resource officers who, although they have a law enforcement role in schools, really their biggest job is being a role model for school kids, showing them that the police officers are approachable, showing them that police officers are human beings, showing them that, you know, we don't have it out for kids. So it's just that whole idea that we're all part of Anchorage, police, non-police, citizens, and so we all have a role in taking care of this city.
Sure, being more connected to the community. And Mr. Campion, the idea of community prosecution, and I want to let our listeners know and our viewers know that there are documents that we'll be putting on the website. One of them is this document that really describes the whole concept of community prosecution, how it got started. It's not so new, really. It got started in the 90s. So it's also an outreach strategy. Kind of give us the 101 on that.
Sure. I think community prosecution has not been around nearly as long as the concept of community policing. And my observation of the way that the district attorney's office has been run, through no fault of my predecessors, but we just hadn't been as engaged in the community as I wanted to be. So the concept is, and you can see from the documents that'll be posted on the internet, that different communities respond differently, but the basic concept is to engage prosecutors directly with the community, with community groups, and to try to figure out strategies to reduce crime, to make people aware of the role of the prosecutor, and like Captain Miller said, to make people understand that we're humans as well. The people that work in our office live in this community. And so we've started the outreach pretty aggressively here in 2016, and I believe we're going to continue to do that. And I'm already amazed at some of the context that I've had as a result of the community council outreach. So I expect that it's going to continue and build as we move forward.
So describe a little bit about how you've been. There's, I think, 13 community councils. I hope I'm right about that.
There's 38.
Oops.
Yeah. So that was
strike that from the record. So 38 community councils in Anchorage, and you've been attending the meetings. That takes time.
It does.
What does it benefit? What are you learning at these meetings?
And I want to say it's not just me. My colleagues are also attending, and what we're trying to do is for those people that live in a community, they're attending their own community council, and they're saying, I live in this community as well, and we want to know what your priorities are. But the concept is we're asking for 5 or 10 minutes, usually only in a community council's meeting, and we explain a little bit about the responsibilities that we have to make people informed about what we do, and then we invite questions or concerns that they have. And it's been amazing that there's been a wide variety of concerns, and I think the one thing that's been true about all the community councils is people are concerned about crime in their neighborhoods, and they certainly want there to be a response from the police department and from our office. They want people to be held accountable, and they want the community standards to be enforced.
Mm-hmm. The idea of community prosecution, was it born out of concern in based on the rise in heroin addiction. Is that kind of where this concept got started?
I think it's heroin and drugs. I mean, my research suggested that there, particularly in inner city communities across the country, people were grappling with what to do with the drug epidemic in the late 80s and early 90s. And so community prosecution developed around those concepts. I don't think that the concepts are outdated at all. I think that they have real relevance today. And I think both Captain Miller and I would agree that, and we discussed this before the interview, that the drug problem is a crisis in our community, and it's something that the police department and the district attorney's office is very much committed to trying to address.
Give us a little context about that. What's the percentage of your caseload that involve drugs?
You know, I don't have the hard numbers, but, you know, anecdotally, anytime we're in court or we're reviewing a case, the expectation is that in almost all of the cases, there's a drug or alcohol component. And often it's in combination with potentially mental health issues and other issues, but drugs and alcohol are almost present in every case. And so that's a factor for us to consider in terms of how do we respond to those offenders and what's going to help them be safe for themselves and for the community as they move forward.
Almost every case?
Yeah, I mean, just anecdotally, I was in court at the jail last Thursday covering a calendar. And I think the first six cases had the heroin was directly involved in the conduct that led to those people being in jail. And I commented to myself, we're six for six for the first six cases. And so the judges, the defense attorneys, the criminal justice system is struggling with what to do with those people that are in the throes of a heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm. Captain Miller, how much mischief does alcohol and drugs cause on the street? What's the percentage of, are you finding the same thing, that the majority of your cases are involve these substances?
Yeah, vast majority. We don't have a solid number because there are things that just slip through the cracks. You're not going to know positively whether or not somebody's high. Obviously there's underreporting. You know, if you ask, you know, if you had anything to drink or smoke or any drugs today, certain number of people are going to say no, in spite of the fact that they have. My guesstimate is probably 80% or better of the things that we're involved in deal with either drugs or alcohol.
Is alcohol still sort of at the top of that spectrum, or is that changing now? I know that in the past, alcohol was, you know, the predominant concern in a lot of burglaries and violent crime. But I know that with the opioid addiction concern on the rise, I'm wondering if that's changing now.
I think it's going to depend on what kind of crime you're talking about. There certainly, you know, thefts, burglaries, shoplifts, the kind of the chain thefts. I'm talking about people that go in and steal time and time again. Probably the majority of that is not so much alcohol, but heroin and opioids, prescription pills, methadone, things like that. Mm-hmm. So it really depends.
If you're wanting to join the conversation, you can do that. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. In Anchorage, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to go to the phones. Bruce is in Anchorage. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for taking my call today. And I just wanted to thank Captain Bill Miller for his leadership. When you look up and down the West Coast, many of the police departments are under federal consent decree. And I think the quality of the police department in Anchorage, Alaska is something we can all be proud of. My question for Captain Miller is, how are we doing on keeping the numbers of officers that you need to do some of these community policing things?
All right. Thanks for the question, Bruce. Captain Miller.
Thanks, Bruce. We are getting better. We've had back-to-back academies for the last 2 years. This year, our goal is to run three academies. We're like every other department in the country, or really every other business in the country. We're continually looking for qualified candidates. If anybody would like to join the Anchorage Police Department, please go to www.joinapd.org, and we'll get you thrown into an application process. It's a great job. We're on the rise, which gives us the ability to do things. We're going to add a second CAP team, which is Community Action Policing. They go around. We look at three things. We look at victims, we look at suspects, and we look at locations. In order for us to have our current makeup, we in order for there to be a crime, you have to have one of those three things. So we try and affect either the environmental design, we try and affect the victims, or we do a great job at arresting bad guys and suspects and putting them in jail. Mm-hmm. So we really try and affect the other two. So we're on the way back.
All right. I've got an email question here. Tom in Fairbanks says, a recent article said, mental health sensitivity training is optional and only about a third of the officers have taken it. Why is this optional, unlike other important training? Why such low participation? Are they really given the time and encouragement to take it? These are all questions from Tom in Fairbanks. Captain Miller?
Yeah, I'm not aware of the article. In the academy, it is not optional. We do things like verbal judo, a very basic CIT training. What is optional and what we ask for volunteers is for the intensive CIT training, because it's like anything else. You have to have a want to do it. These people can be emotionally trying. I even now have three or four people that call me on almost a daily basis, sometimes many times a day, just to talk. And that's what CIT officers sign up for. We are the outlet for people, rather than having to have a patrol officer go and respond to whatever their crisis at the time is. Mm-hmm. So for the really intensive part, to become essentially a case manager or a case supervisor, I'm doing a poor job of articulating it, but for that really intensive one, yeah, it's voluntary. You have to want to do it, because it can be trying.
Emotional draining.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Campion, your office, the Anchorage DA's office, handles cases, prosecutions in Dillingham and the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands. How do the community relationships compare, Anchorage versus these island communities, when you're doing this kind of outreach work?
It's a real challenge, I can tell you. We don't have prosecutors that live in those communities, and frankly, none of the prosecutors in the office have ever lived in those communities. We have a prosecutor in Dillingham right now, and she's in the middle of a trial week, so she's dealing with that. So the best we can do is we can get out there for trials. We can be on the phone with the police officers. And for members of those communities, we invite your input, because it's more difficult for me to attend community meetings in Naknek and Sandpoint and Unalaska, but those are priorities for us. And we've one of the things we've done the last year is we've reorganized so that we can put more experienced and more capable prosecutors responsible for those communities, so that they're getting some of our very best prosecutors dealing with those cases.
And do you notice, I'm sure you do, a difference in the interactions with the public in those communities versus when you're here and being seen a lot in a low-pressure setting, such as a community council meeting?
Certainly. I mean, if you're flying in the night before a jury trial and you're trying to assess because a big part of what we do is present cases to a jury, and the jury is made up of members of the community, and so having a better feeling for what the jurors' priorities or the community priorities are makes us more effective in our job and identifying what the community priorities are. So it is a challenge, and it's one of the things we're going to be focusing on as we move forward, ways to do more outreach in our rural communities.
All right. We are talking about community policing and community prosecution and more interaction between law enforcement officials and the communities that they are working in, as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Elder Mentor Program brings the wisdom of Alaskan elders into the classrooms and the communities across the state. Elders age 55 and older share their compassion, social support, and cultural values with the next generation. Earn a small stipend while supporting the educational staff and children. Alaska's Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Let's go to the phones again. Paul is in Trapper Creek. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Did you have a question?
Yes. Basically, it's a comment. It's about the relationship that everyone has whenever they encounter anybody, and that includes the police when they encounter people in the community. It's a hierarchical relationship where someone is the alpha and someone is lower in the chain, in the pecking order. And what is happening, I see, and this isn't just in Alaska, this is all over the nation, is that the police, whenever they encounter people, they demand that this hierarchical relationship be established where they are the alpha. And whenever they don't see clear signs or signals of submission from the people that they encounter, then they force that situation to be one where they are clearly in control, clearly in a more prestigious position. And a lot of times that ends up with the people they encounter being in handcuffs because they don't show what they deem as the proper respect. Now, my comment is that if the police and the prosecutors never realize that aspect of the relationships, fundamental human relationships, they will never come to a solution to the problem they're encountering now and that you're talking about today.
Captain Miller, would you like to respond to this idea that police, based on what Paul's saying, there's this relationship he's alluding to that police are showing that they are in control of a situation, and it sounds like he's alluding to maybe an escalation beyond that.
I think in some cases he's right. We get paid to address situations that are oftentimes ugly, oftentimes sticky, and a lot of times very dangerous. And so in those cases, he is absolutely right. We are paid to be the ones who are in control. We are paid to be the ones who resolve that relationship. There are other times that I disagree with him. Community council meetings, for example, minority task force meetings. There are things that happen in those meetings with those relationships that I don't agree with all the time. And, that's fine. I don't have to be the one that's right all the time, and sometimes I'm not. So I think a lot of it really depends on the situation and what's at stake.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks, Paul, for the call. I wanted to ask a question about your work out in the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands and in those communities, Mr. Campion. Do the community concerns about crime differ greatly in that part of the state than they do in Anchorage, or are a lot of these concerns fairly common?
I think they're common. I mean, the heroin epidemic is certainly true in the rural communities that we prosecute cases in. That's true. One of the things that's always a priority for every community is dangerous drivers. And whether it's drunk driving or other distracted driving, that's a community priority. In every size community, that's always a concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones for just a moment. Hank is in Palmer. Hi, Hank.
Yes, hi. Say, I'm enjoying the dialogue. And to just dovetail off the last gentleman's comment, I think the venue for dialogue is key. Building relationships in safe, appropriate places like communities, councils, and community meetings maybe lays the groundwork for dealing with those extreme situations where the troopers are put in a situation where there's unknowns left and right in the dark, in the Alaska environment, and they have to go home at night to their families. So trying to keep our neighborhood safe, maybe it's a multiple-tiered approach of relationship building. But real quick, I was robbed by two heroin addicts midday out here in Palmer, lost a car and a job, et cetera. And then tracked the court system, pre-trials, grand jury, saw the culture. And like the officer mentioned, culture of crime and the culture of the troopers. But rows and rows of mostly young men shackled together. I'd say 80% of the individuals were there for heroin-related crime. And so my whole perspective really was I was educated up about safety here, out here where I am. And I can't appreciate enough the work the officers do. When, as they say, try walking a mile in someone's shoes who wants to go home at night to their families, like the troopers and APD would like to do, keeping our communities safe.
All right.
So
well,
thank you.
Thanks, Hank. Thanks for the call and for your comments. This is Talk of Alaska. We are talking about crime prevention and community policing, community prosecution, what those concepts mean. Captain Miller, going back to some of the earlier comments about escalation between officers and citizens and some of the calls that we've had, how do you think Alaska compares to other states when it comes to that confidence level that there is between citizens and police? The Fairbanks 4 case comes to mind and some of what we've seen recently. How does Alaska compare in that regard, do you think?
Well, I'll speak for Anchorage, and obviously I'm biased, but I think we have a outstanding relationship with the community, and that's one of the things that I've always been impressed about. I have relatives and friends who are police officers in other states, and I just don't see the amount of community outreach to the police department that we do here at Anchorage. I think we enjoy a very, very good relationship with the community. Just take a look at the amount of community involvement in things like Citizens Police Academy, the Citizens Alumni Association, Dollars for Dogs. Dollars for Dogs allows the Anchorage Police Department to have as big of a canine unit as we do to help things like track for evidence, track for lost people, go looking for the bank robber or the robber. We had the Citizens Academy people come out and help us look for drivers that are OUI or operating under the influence of intoxicants. We had people come out and help us look for red light runners. There's a lot of communities where you just don't see that buy-in to help with law enforcement and help make the community a better place. So admittedly, I'm biased, but I think that we enjoy a far greater relationship with our community than a lot of places, even sometimes here in Alaska.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Roger is in White Mountain. Hi, Roger.
Yeah, good morning. If the state of Alaska empties out our prisons to save $500 million this budget round, will we see a spike in social ills, i.e. domestic violence, thefts, DUIs, etc.? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Thanks, Roger. Hopefully we don't just empty out the prisons, because I think we would definitely see a big spike in some crimes.
Right. I'll address, respond to Roger. From my perspective, and I'm frankly not in Juneau, I'm not part of those discussions, but from my perspective, what we as prosecutors in connection with our law enforcement partners have to determine is, who are the population of people that we think should be in jail? And the way we do that is we have to be smarter about identifying the people that pose the biggest risk to the community. And we have to look at a lot of different factors. But there's a core group of people that do present a danger to the community, to their families. And those are the people that we're going to continue to prosecute, and we're going to do everything we can to keep them incarcerated. And then what I think is being done in Juneau, what we're doing with all of our criminal justice system partners, is to try to identify smarter ways for those people who aren't really dangerous. For example, people that are on probation or parole, we're trying to develop strategies to perhaps reduce the amount of time that they spend in jail, but then get them more plugged into treatment programs or rehabilitative programs to hold them accountable, but not leave them in jail indefinitely, where they become particularly soured on their probation officer, on the criminal justice system, and government as a whole. As I've said often publicly, even the people that I've prosecuted for homicides are likely to return to the community at some point. And the vast majority of people that come in contact with the police and the prosecution do end up back in our communities. So all of us have an obligation to be smart about how can we have better success rates for those people returning to the communities.
Are your numbers of prosecutors, I think that you've had some reductions in the last 5 years or so.
Yes.
So you've gone from... what to what?
Well, we're down about 6 or 7 prosecutors when you include our responsibilities in rural Alaska, and that's just for Anchorage and the south central, southwest part that we're responsible for. So we have fewer prosecutors. So we, again, that's part of our effort and community engagement is to try to prioritize cases for those that pose the biggest danger and create the biggest concerns for communities.
When you have fewer prosecutors that can work cases, does that mean that you have to, compromise might be a poor choice of words, but are you having to consider reducing charges or dropping charges in some cases because you just simply can't handle the caseload?
Yes, and so that's absolutely true. We have to make those decisions more quickly, more efficiently, and without all of the information that perhaps we would have been able to utilize 5 or 10 years ago. So we're really looking at the snapshot that the police provide to us, and they've made an arrest, often a domestic violence arrest or robbery or theft, vehicle theft, for example, and we've got a snapshot of information, but we don't have the amount of time to really sink into it and dig into those histories as much as we'd like to. We've reorganized our office and we put very capable and experienced people into that role. And so we've got all those prosecutors have 10 years or more experience, and all they're doing is looking at the cases that come in every day. Our office is open, just like the Anchorage Police. We're open 365 days a year, and we're looking at what happens in our communities, and we're responding to it the best way we can.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. Tim is in Anchorage. Hi, Tim. Tim? Maybe we lost him. All right.
No.
Hello. Are you there? All right. Well, we had Tim, but he's gone. Maybe he can call us back. If you'd like to join us, 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-TALK is the statewide number. And 550-8422. 550-8422 is the number in Anchorage. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Captain Miller, APD has a new crime software program. Before we discuss that, let's talk about the one that's been in place for a little bit, the Nixle system. When did APD first start using this particular app and making it available to the public?
Oh, man, I think it's been about a year and a half or 2 years, maybe. Mm-hmm. And it's great. I have it on my phone, my wife, everybody that I talk to. And I highly encourage people. Can I tell them what it is?
Absolutely. Yes.
So Nixle is a service that the Anchorage Police Department provides. And any time that we have something that's going on that affects the community, whether it's, for instance, the other day we had the heavy snow. We closed down the Glen Highway going out to Eagle River. We closed it down coming into town at Bregaw. We closed down the Seward Highway. You get a text that comes in over your phone and says, hey, avoid this part of town because we've got this going on. It could be everything from missing people. We send out probably 4 or 5 missing person things a week to closed roads, to whenever we're doing, like if we have a SWAT operation, somebody's barricaded, we'll send it out so that people know that their neighborhood's affected. It's a really, really, really good up-to-the-minute service. And the beauty of it is that when we notify the TV stations and the radio stations, we do Nixle at the same time. So people are getting information even before the radio stations and TV stations can put it out because they get it to them directly from us.
So you're scooping us, in other words.
I hate to say it, but yes.
Is there any concern that people might have a skewed perspective on the amounts of crime because of these alerts? Because, you know, they're coming into your phone and you're like, yikes, right, there's crime around every corner. Has there been any concern or conversation about how the public might be perceiving what's going on based on the fact that they're getting these immediate text alerts?
I think even more than that, it's the internet and the immediacy of information in general. You take a look at any website on the internet, any news feed on the internet, and it's just full of terrible news. The world is falling apart. And I think just my personal opinion is that skews people's view of crime and what's really going on in the community. So that's a great segue for Bear and Bear Analytics.
Yes, the new software. Please tell us about that.
So Bear, B-A-I-R, it is a analytical service that we contract out with. And what we do is we dump in all of our police reports to it. Our crime analysts use it to figure out what kind of deployments we should have and what kind of areas we should watch into. But the most important part of that, to me, is the fact that the public can get onto that website and they can see what's actually going on in their neighborhood or their community council area or Anchorage at large. Just sign onto the website, get into Anchorage, and you can be your own crime analyst and spend as much time as you want digging down as deep as you want into any kind of crime information that the Anchorage Police Department has. We put every report that we have into it. We have some things, obviously, that we don't show the public, like specific domestic violence addresses, sexual assault addresses, victims' names, and other things that are protected by law. But you can get a really, really good snapshot of crime in individual areas of Anchorage just by logging onto that website.
When you're plugging in, I went on the site yesterday and just looked around a little bit at the map itself, and it would be easy to get overwhelmed a bit by, mm-hmm. yikes, look at all these dots that indicate all this crime. When someone reports a crime such as a sexual assault or a rape, are those reports primarily aggregating near where people are reporting the crime, or is there a method to go back to saying, once the report is taken in at the police department or wherever it is there an effort then to incorporate the general area of where that crime took place for the map so that people can look at that and say, geez, don't go walking there late at night by yourself?
Sure.
How is that finding its way back to this map?
With any analytical system, you're going to end up with some kind of anomalies. One of the things is that if you look at where the Anchorage Police Department is, you're going to see a huge spike in crime. That's because we get a lot of reports that are called into the Anchorage Police Department. Somebody may not know where they got their car broken into. All they know is that their camera's gone. So by default, we use the Anchorage Police Department. Other places that you'll notice are hospitals. You'll notice intersections, busy intersections. So there are going to be some anomalies like that that you cannot clear up. The other thing is that the public-facing side of that, even though the police department can see down to the address and we use that for planning and stuff like that, we offset all of those reports so that you can't tell specific houses and
sure.
and identify specific people and stuff like that. So, again, it gives a good general snapshot, but you will see anomalies in there for different places. Fred Meyer, obviously they're going to have a lot of things going on there, cars, other places that you would typically expect that to happen.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Tim is trying to get back on. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how are you today?
Good.
Somebody earlier spoke about locking up the bad guys, and I kind of want to take a position with that because it sounds like, well, I grew up with a cop. My dad retired as a lieutenant from the police department where I grew up, and locking up the bad guys is just a mentality that really bothers me because, you know, when the police are there in a situation, I think they should try to defuse it. And when we walk, get out of that car with a gun on our holster and say, we're here to lock up the bad guys. That's the mentality. I hear it. And I saw it and I witnessed it as a kid growing up. Locking up the bad guys isn't what we need, especially when the prosecutor speaks about 6 for 6 of drug cases in the courts there. So the issue really is we've got a drug problem in this country. We've had a drug problem. And no matter how many people we lock up, it's not going to go away. So we need treatment. Does this area have a drug court? I'm really concerned that we're not treating the problem. My son just went to prison, not here, but in another state, and he got no treatment when he was in prison. He wanted to get some education while he was there. He had to sign up. He had to be there for, 5 or 10 years before they'd let him get some education. Hmm. He got no treatment while he was there. Guess what? He's back out doing drugs again. I don't want to minimize it, but it's just marijuana, thank goodness. Because personally, I think marijuana shouldn't be a criminal act. And a lot of the people that are in jail right now are in jail because of drugs.
Okay,
and
well,
we're not treating the problem. We're
right.
putting a Band-Aid on it. And if we do empty out the jails, most of them have drug problems. So why don't we have treatment facilities set up so that we can address the problem? Because the jails don't care.
All right. Well, thank you, Tim, for that call and your honesty with the the very real problems that you're dealing with in your own family, which are, of course, difficult. And we are going to give both District Attorney Clint Campion and also Captain Miller a chance to respond to that. But we got to take a quick break. So as Talk of Alaska continues statewide, we'll address these issues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Full Circle, delivering organic produce and artisan groceries, including Alaskan products across Alaska. Learn more about Full Circle's partner producers at fullcircle.com/APRN.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. So let's get some response. Captain Miller, we'll start with you to Tim's very heartfelt message and call about treatment as opposed to locking people up.
Depends on the crime. I take a pretty fair number of calls from victims of home invasions and robberies and assaults and shootings and stabbings and sexual assaults, sexual abuse of minors, child porn, who are upset that the perpetrators are not locked up. So while I agree that we need treatment, there is a time and place and a certain, there are acts that demand for the safety of the public that some people be put in jail.
And the idea of drug court, I saw you nodding, Mr. Campion, when Tim was talking about the concept of drug courts. What's going on in that respect in this area?
We've had a wellness court, which is our drug court in Anchorage, and that's been in existence for many years. And in the last year or two, the Sheriff Marshall, the prior district attorney, and I both have agreed to sort of expand the category of people that we would put in drug court. In the past, we would keep people that had been dealing heroin at a lower level. We would just keep them out. Now we're able to consider that. So we have a drug court. Like everything else, it's a limited resource, and we have to be judicious about who we put into that. We need to make sure that we're putting the right people in there. Some people can receive treatment in the community. They may get involved with the criminal justice system, but they can receive treatment in the community, and those may not be people that we put in our wellness court. We've also got a veterans court where we deal with veteran-specific issues, including substance abuse issues. We have a coordinated resources project court, which is a mental health court to deal with people that have acute mental health issues, to get them partnered up with social services. And then we've got a variety of different responses for people on probation, including mental health offenders, substance abuse folks. So we are aware of the concerns of the community that we need to get people into treatment. That's a priority for us. But like Captain Miller said, there are categories of offenses where treatment is not the number one priority. The number one priority is to reaffirm community standards and to keep the community safe.
Well, and at times it takes an arrest of activity to kind of stop what's going on before people can get assessed for treatment as well, I would imagine. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Tara is in Homer. Hi.
Hi, everybody. I'm really excited to hear that this community discussion being talked about so thoughtfully. I started tuning in when you guys were talking about the concept of community prosecution, this idea that everybody in the community kind of has their eyes open for warning signs of crime or what that might be. And I was recently in Anchorage for a Green Dot training, and I know that there's some really exciting things going on in the communities around Alaska where we're encouraging people to look out for each other, especially in instances of violent crime. And you were talking about that map of, you know, a dot showing up on the map for every violent crime. And with Green Dot, when bystanders get involved, either directly by asking them to stop what they're doing, by delegating to police, or by simply distracting and getting the violence to stop that way, then we add a green dot to the map. And I see it tying into this idea of community prosecution, but I would encourage people to reframe it to think about it as more community stewardship, and that we are all in this together and we all want to create safer communities, and that there's something that each and every person can do to get involved to stop that.
All right. Well, thank you for those comments. That's tracking well with what we've been discussing today. And I want to let people know that we do have documents on alaskapublic.org that you can go look at about community prosecutions and also about the Raids Online software program that APD is launching. In our last minute or so, I wanted to ask about the very complexion of the Anchorage Police Department. It is more than 80% white. I know that there are efforts underway to diversify the force so that it looks more like the very, very diverse community that we live in Anchorage. Talk about what is happening in that regard, Captain Miller.
Well, that's another thing like fighting crime. We need the community's help. We continually go out and ask different communities to put their best people forward and have them come to the Anchorage Police Department. Law enforcement is and always has been an honorable profession. And in Anchorage, you can make a good living being a police officer, be very involved in your community. I think as communities change, the face of law enforcement also changes. I'll date myself. I started in law enforcement with the military back in the early 80s, went to the troopers in 84, and then came to Anchorage Police Department. It was an anomaly to see a female who was a police officer, commonplace now. The same thing for other minorities on the Anchorage Police Department. You know, it was even more skewed back then. And I think as the face of the community changes and communities get more involved and kind of understand that the Anchorage Police Department, that's their department. If you want to have quality officers, put them forward. Have them apply to the Anchorage Police Department.
And how does that that same line of thinking for prosecutors? What does your office look like, Mr. Campion?
Well, I would say we are predominantly white, but we have had a pretty good balance over the years between males and females, and that's certainly a priority for myself to have our office be reflective of the community that we serve. One of the things we've done is we've become very aggressive in reaching out to potential interns, both at a paralegal or a college level, and then for law students. And so we've got a couple local kids who are going to help diversify the office, and they're going to work with us next summer. And the goal is to increase that as we move forward.
All right. Well, thank you so much to my guests, Anchorage District Attorney Clint Campion, and also APD Captain of Crime Suppression Bill Miller in the studio. Thanks to Dave Waldron on the board and Josh Edge on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast, and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.